You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When the Berlin Wall came down in 1989, it marked the end of the Communist German Democratic Republic, and it also ended the activities of the secret police, the Stasi. Their archives, where files on every citizen was kept, were stormed as people tried to learn what the Stasi had collected about them. Petra Epperlein's family grew up in Chemnitz, which was renamed Karl Marx City during the GDR years. In a documentary called Karl Marx City, directors Petra Epperlein and Michael Tucker examine life during the GDR period and what happened after the wall fell through the perspectives of Petra's own family. It opens today at Film Forum, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Petra Epperlein and Michael Tucker to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
How did the two of you end up working together on this film?
We actually met here in New York City in 1994. We met at a show at the Kitchen. She asked me for a cigarette, and she got pregnant about 6 months later.
Six weeks later.
It was a very fast relationship, and then I moved to Berlin with her.
Ah, and so was this something that you had talked about, a project that you talked about doing for a while?
Well, it's interesting. I moved to Germany in 95, and so that was 6 years after the wall fell. And the fascination with all things East German was very much with us, and our first short film was about East Germany.
And Petra, you are a trained architect, so did you always know you wanted to make films?
No, actually I didn't. After I finished study as architect, I realized that it's a really slow process, and I was just not patient enough for building, so I
And when you decided to make this film, did you always know that you wanted to include yourself and your family?
No, actually, it was a really long decision process to start making this film. The story, of course, has been with us for a long time, right? The wall came down 27 years ago, and my father committed suicide 17 years ago, and since then, it was brewing, it was around, but we only decided to make a film basically 4 years ago.
But the suicide was one of the main reasons that got you, was one of the main things that got you thinking about telling this story.
Actually, moving to America triggered the wish to make a film, because I came here and I realized that many people don't know much about East Germany or the Stasi at all. If they knew anything, then they knew about it from the movie The Lives of the Others. Mm. And I thought there would be room for other stories.
And Michael, you say that although that's a good movie, that is not completely accurate?
Well,
Lives of the Others, which I thought was a terrific film.
Well, it is a terrific film, and it paints like a very vivid portrait of what life was like in East Germany, but it has the problem, you know, in the main character, the Stasi man, that there is no record of anyone like that ever existing, someone who actively helped, someone that they had under observation. And, you know, there were people that we spoke to who had helped and consulted on that film, and they said it's, you know, it was sort of pitched as like a Schindler's List sort of story. Well, you know, Schindler existed, but this Stasi man didn't. And, you know, it's a problematic sort of revisionist way to see history, and it's important for people to understand, like, how a dictatorship functions and, you know, what's really there.
You spoke to Hubertus Knabe, the director of the Stasi prison in Hohenschönhausen, which is now a memorial. What did he say about that film?
He has a high opinion of the film, but, you know, he is in the business, he's a historian, he's in the business of accuracy, and it's important that we see history as it was, especially like in an age when, you know, facts are very fluid.
Petra, so you grew up in the GDR, yes, in East Germany, and you've lived in the West. What would we be surprised to have learn about what the country was like when you were growing up?
Actually, the surprising fact was, actually, from your point of view, how normal life was. We just lived our lives. My childhood was happy. I had loving parents when I was a teenager. We had wild parties. I had boyfriends. All the normal things. And people think here from the West, they probably have a perception that everything was much darker and more grim than it really was.
But there was it colored at all by the fact that Chemnitz's name was changed to Karl Marx City? Had Karl Marx visited the city?
Yeah, that was a strange thing imposed by the Communist Party upon the people of Chemnitz. Karl Marx has never been to Chemnitz, but it was a workers' town. There were many factories, so they thought like they honor the workers by naming it Karl Marx City, and it was so hated because it's such an awkward name.
Did you realize when you were growing up the extent of surveillance in East Germany?
Yeah, from a pretty early age, everyone was aware that the Stasi existed and that one had to be careful what to say in public and what not. But, of course, I didn't know like the numerical, the extent, how many people were doing what. And
so it wasn't completely normal in the way people in the West might understand normal, because unless there is a reason for the FBI to be investigating us, we just don't assume that we are being watched.
Yes, exactly. It was just a different kind of normal. We all got used to it. And as long as you just like lived your life and didn't interfere really with the system, nothing really bad happened to you. Although I have to say that's also a wrong impression, as we find out during the making of that movie.
The problem for me in having this conversation is I don't want to spoil the ending for people, but it is a fascinating story. Did your parents ever talk about politics and the regime with you and your brothers?
Yes, actually, and dinner conversations were always very lively and political. It was always very much anti the existing regime. But of course, that happened around our dinner table, and everyone knew exactly that's where the conversation would stay and not be carried anywhere outside of the home.
But when friends visited, were you ever suspicious that some of them might be reporting to the Stasi?
Well, there were friends and friends. You always knew who were your friends and who weren't really your friends.
And did you know people who worked for the Stasi?
Well, yes, I actually had a friend in school whose parents worked for the Stasi. Everyone knew that, so you would behave accordingly.
Michael, the system seems rather sophisticated and high tech. How did the Stasi operate?
I mean, it's unbelievable when you go into the archive in Berlin and see just how meticulous and analog the Stasi worked compared to like what we think of today as digital surveillance. I mean, they have literally millions of card catalog files. What's the total number? Do you remember?
I don't remember. Millions.
But was it every person who
was
being watched?
It wasn't every person, but like many, many, many addresses. Like they were trying to basically catalog everything. And had the regime continued and had they had computers, they probably would have had a very sophisticated system.
They had informants working for them. Were these just people who felt it was their duty, or were they paid?
That's a good question. Some of them probably just voluntarily signed up for that job. But many people were asked, and there were different methods to make people work for the Stasi. Some of them were put under pressure, like they were blackmailed. So it's very difficult, like in retrospect, to understand why people did certain things. But at the same time, you know, there are many people who were asked by the Stasi who then just said, no, we are not going to work with you.
Although many people who've been caught, who've prominent people, I think, is the writer Paula Wolf, they said that they were coerced. They had no choice.
Yeah, many people say that, and it's hard to put any judgment upon them. But as I said, I think many people refuse to work with them. So there's always a moral guidance, what everyone has to have for themselves.
And they weren't just reporting. Didn't they have to use cameras and other forms of technology? Were they trained?
I think the informants were just reporting on people. It was more about the direct access to friends and family members. The camera work and the recording was done by the Stasi officers.
How does your mother talk about that time now? Does she talk about the feeling that they were always being watched?
Actually, my mother's view on the whole experience changed pretty profoundly through the making of the film, which we can see when we watch the story unfold. I don't really want to give too much away. In the beginning, she was very apologetic, and she was talking about how life was just ordinary and like she had nothing to do with the Stasi.
Can you explain the concepts of ostalgi and Erinnerungskultur? Forgive my pronunciation.
Well, the idea of ostalgia comes from nostalgia, and this is a very unique East German thing. I mean, you have to imagine this is a country that does not exist anymore. Mm-hmm. It's been erased off the map, names have been changed, streets have been renamed, everything's been erased.
It's back to Chemnitz.
It's back to Chemnitz, but also to, you know, when she, in her passport, it says she was born in Karl Marx City. That place does not exist anymore, and I think that idea of ostalgia, that idea of nostalgia, of wanting to remember your past like in a golden sort of way.
So people remember the communist years in a positive way? In the old days, this wouldn't have happened kind of thing?
Well, it's complicated. It's not that black and white. I mean, there are certain elements, you know, in East Germany, the concept of unemployment, for instance, did not exist. So people have a certain romantic idea about what happened 30 years ago. And of course, when something is gone, everything is much nicer than it when it really existed. But back to your word, Erinnerungskultur, the culture of remembrance. I mean, Germany has a long history of how would you call it, events would need to be dealt with. So yes, there's a specific culture.
I'm speaking with Petra Epperlein and Michael Tucker about their film Karl Marx City, which opens today at Film Forum. Germans called the fall of the wall and the end of the GDR Die Wende, which means the turn?
Yes.
What was the general feeling in Karl Marx City when the wall came down?
Should I explain the turn a little bit?
Sure.
The turn comes from the point that many Communist Party members, within like minutes sometimes, decided to become revolutionaries. So they turned. That's where it all comes from.
And I find this interesting because Hitler said that he assumed that a lot of communists would join the National Socialist Party once he came to power because there were certain shared sensibilities.
Which actually happened, yes.
Yeah. But so this is a lot of twisting and turning throughout German history, from very far left to very far right.
Yeah, obviously Germans are good at this. So yeah, so there's this term, but that's why you need to have the special culture of remembrance so you don't forget what actually really happened and who's responsible for what in history.
Did people immediately leave for the West?
Yes, people left already before the wall came down. This was a whole summer of people running away to the embassies in Budapest and Prague, and then from there trying to get to West Germany.
How did this Wende affect your parents' lives?
Yeah, that was interesting. Things happened which they didn't expect to happen. Right after the wall came down, the East German economy basically collapsed. So my parents both lost their jobs, which they didn't anticipate when they went to protest the regime. They did get back on their feet and they built a successful business. So they were lucky, but many people were really left over because they were too old or they couldn't reorient themselves in the system.
And that was a problem that unification had to deal with. Suddenly, many people were concerned in the West that unification would mean that people in the West were going to have to bail out people in the East, especially since so many of the industries were kind of inefficient.
Yeah, they were happy about the reunification on one level, but of course they were concerned how expensive it would be for them in the end. And I'm not even sure if they're still paying to this day or not. But at the same time, you know, it was a huge chance because it opened up this East Germany. It was also a market, like 17 million people.
And then people are going to the Stasi files and trying to find out which ones of their friends were their real friends.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fascinating. I mean, people storming the archives, wanting to see their files. And one of the really unique things about the Stasi archive in German history is that's really the only, it was the first place, but it's still really the only open archive like that in the world, where you can go in, there's a process, and all this data is
and
managed.
They don't redact anything? Because if I were to ask, let's say the FBI had a file on me, I don't know if it does, but if I were to ask for it, I suspect that some names would be redacted.
Yeah, so in the Stasi archive, there are pretty strict rules about what you can actually learn and what you can't, but the reason is to protect the privacy of the people who were spied upon because, you know, it was an illegal way of collecting information, and their privacy needs to be protected.
When did you first see the anonymous letters that your father received in the early 1990s?
After my father committed suicide, my mother showed them to us, to me and my brothers.
And they accused him of being an informant for the Stasi?
Yes, they basically said, like, you Stasi swine, you were an informant and we are going to get you.
So the mystery of this film, which, as I said, we're not going to reveal, is, was my father actually an informant for the Stasi?
Exactly. So we tried to figure out who wrote these letters, or is there anything about the letters?
And when you interview people in the film, you have a microphone that has a huge covering on it, and you wear a big hat. That's to call attention to yourself so that people won't think that you're secretly recording what's going on?
Actually, you know, people ask me that question all the time. I have been using that microphone since, like, 2000. I've traveled in Australia and Africa with it.
You just like it.
That's just the way we work together.
Michael, you interview Udo Grashoff for the film. Isn't he an expert on East German suicide? Were there a lot of suicides in East Germany before the fall, or did they? Were there a lot after the fall of the wall?
Well, we found Udo while we were making the film, doing research, and he was actually asked to be a consultant also on The Lives of Others. And as people might recall, in The Lives of Others, there's a scene, there's this whole part of the film about a Spiegel magazine cover coming out about the hidden suicide statistics in East Germany. But again, much like the other story about The Lives of Others, it's also not true. The fact is that he studied East German suicide rates, and as it turned out, they weren't any different than the West. Regionally, there were differences, but you couldn't, you know, attribute suicide to political motives.
Your father sent you a letter right before he killed himself. What did the letter say?
He was basically wishing me all the best in my life and saying it would be time to leave Germany.
But he wasn't saying it wasn't a real farewell letter.
Yeah, it was very formal.
Did he send letters to your brothers and your mother as well?
No, I was the only person who received anything.
What makes the letter so peculiar? Wasn't it accompanied by a postcard?
Yeah, he also sent me a postcard, but I had sent him like in 1990, right after reunification, and I had some remarks about the reunification on it, and he just told me that he kept that all the time. And
he signed the letter with Ganz liebe herzliche Grüße. What does that translate into English?
It's hard to translate.
Again, forgive my German.
Yeah, ganz liebe herzliche Grüße. It's more like best regards. It's a relatively formal expression. I think, we agonized about this letter a lot. We also showed it to Dr. Grashoff and debated it. It's a suicide letter, so it's a difficult.
Did your mother tell you whether your father had ever tried to see his Stasi files?
According to my mother, he never tried to see his file, no.
And wasn't your mother at first reluctant when you told her to request a look into the files?
Yeah, so my mother, of course, she knew about all these stories of, like, spouses spying on each other, friends spying on each other, and she was like, yeah, I rather don't want to know what happened because, you know, the truth might be hard to stomach. Mm-hmm. So she had to convince her.
Maybe it's better not to know, she's
basically
saying.
But I think in the end she's kind of glad that she went along with us, and although it was painful.
And you were living in the United States at the time that your father killed himself?
No, I was visiting here. Actually, I was still living in Germany.
Michael, what was it like to visit the Stasi archive buildings? You visited the ones in Berlin and the ones in Chemnitz. Were there Stasi archive buildings all throughout Germany?
Well, each region has its own Stasi headquarters, so all over the country there are these repositories of files, but the one in Berlin is the center, and it's truly an incredible thing, and I encourage anyone who goes to Berlin, you can visit there, and it's really an eye-opening
experience. Weren't some of the files shredded when the wall came down?
Yeah, after the wall came down, they had 16,000 hefty bags of documents were found that were like in various stages of shredding. Some were just ripped, some were really shredded, some had been put into chemical solutions, and now they're trying to piece all of those back together, and I think they've only made it, it's a tiny percentage. literally women have sat at tables gluing these documents back together, and now they're trying to use the computers. I think the government wants to cut funding now because they say it's silly to do this, but...
Do you think it's silly?
I don't think it's silly. It's a sign of empowerment, you know. There's this one archivist, she says, the Stasi didn't want us to know what was in these files, but we don't let them have that power. We want to know what's in it. And it's actually interesting, even the Fraunhofer Institute developed a software to piece the puzzle pieces together faster. I mean, it's still going, it's a Sisyphean task, but I think it's good.
People who do jigsaw puzzles must
yes.
be very good at it.
Yeah.
Now, you did ask for your father's file. How long before you were able to get it?
My father's file, I saw my mother's file, and in my mother's file was all the information about my father.
Now, I'm not going to spoil it, as I said, by revealing what the file said, but... It does lead to a very interesting end to the film. You couldn't have known that you were going to be really making a mystery film when you started this.
Well, we had the mystery in the beginning, and of course it could have ended like many different ways, and so it ended one way. It's painful on a certain level. It's kind of hard to talk about it, not giving the end away.
Well, we do want people to go see it at the Film Forum.
Yes. So it was a painful story, but I'm really glad.
But I suspect yours is not the only family that has gone through something like this.
No, many people actually. And we interviewed, we talked to some people before who were in similar situation, trying to figure out if their parents worked for the Stasi or not and how they reacted once they found out. It's always...
What is Chemnitz like now? Do you still see the traces of its East German history?
Well, the funny thing about Chemnitz has the lowest birth rate in the world. And that's a really, I mean, the whole eastern part of Germany has this declining birth rate. They're actually tearing down apartment blocks. In a strange way, the migration crisis is offering Germany an opportunity that suddenly you have this huge quantity of people coming in, and like maybe you can revive some of these places and keep them alive.
So are immigrants coming in from other parts of the world?
Oh, yeah. I mean, 1.5 million refugees came to Germany last year.
No, I meant to this area in particular.
Well, yeah, they are being distributed. Yes, they are there too. But like the most telling sign of remnants of East Germany is this enormous Karl Marx bronze head in the middle of town. Like after the wall came down, you probably remember all the Lenins and Karl Marxes were like removed. But that one was so enormous. It's still there.
I was photographed in front of in Berlin, in front of a statue. What was it? It's Marx and Engels.
Yeah.
Engels.
But it's tiny in comparison to
really?
Marx. It's like 35 meters high.
It's
and
still
it's
huge.
So heavy, it could not be moved.
So what do you think people gain from seeing this film? Do you feel that the story of East Germany still has to be told?
I mean, I hope for two things. Number one, they get some understanding of how the regime worked back in the day and daily life also. And then the other thing is they remember how the absence of trust within a society, which the Stasi very much succeeded to destroy, how if there is no trust, a society can't work. And people should remember that, where it leads to, even today, when there are many forces trying to destroy trust in many institutions, what are essential to the functioning of democracy, like media.
Petra Eberlein and Michael Tucker's film Karl Marx City opens today at Film Forum. Thank you both so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.